leans back and starts rolling a cigarette, pretending to watch the pigeons fighting the seagulls for a scrap of sandwich yanked from a dustbin. Every bird for himself. He doesn't look at the girl and her mother fussing and fretting as they carry the boxes inside. But he can hear everything. And if he stares down contemplatively at his shoes while he's rolling, he can see them out the side of his eye. That's Harper Curtis from Lauren Bucus's novel, The Shining Girls. Harper is a serial killer who doesn't inhabit any particular time stream. If that means traveling to 1992 or bouncing around 1931, Harper will do it. And in those times, he hunts women who have pluck and potential. These are the shining girls of the book's title. So what I loved about this book was the way Harper is not your typical evil serial killer. What he does is monstrous, but as the passage I read suggests, there's also this intimation that society itself, with the every man for himself, every bird for himself idea, is also partly to blame. Now, there's also a young woman named Kirby. She's a reporter. She is every bit Harper's match. She has survived a terrible attempt on her life, but Bucus doesn't shy away from how this incident has shaped her, and we'll go into it in the following conversation. She is thankfully not some damsel in distress who is following in the footsteps of a more experienced newspaperman. She is someone who can take control. So this book I really liked. It's almost the perfect antidote to the ongoing sexism that we're seeing in science fiction circles, which we've seen most recently from Mike Resnick and Barry Maltzberg, who had the foolish temerity to suggest in a recent issue of the CIFWA Bulletin that any criticism or counterpoint to the idea that women are little more than sex objects was censorship, the work of liberal fascists. No, Mr. Resnick and Mr. Maltzberg, it's very simple. If you cling so lovingly to misogyny, then you're going to be called out for your bullshit in 2013. That's not censorship, it's not fascism, it's not even shutting you down. It's being taken to task for expressing an asinine viewpoint. Anyway, I had talked before with Lauren for Zoo City, which is also a wonderful book, and earlier in the year, Lauren contacted me. I wasn't doing Bat Segundo, I was kind of doing Follow Your Ears. She told me that she had this new book, and she told me that she was coming through town. So I read the book, dug it, and we had a conversation that got into everything from how to feel empathy for terrible people to why fictional sociopaths tend to drink Canadian Club. So sit back, relax, and enjoy Lauren Bucus! Okay, so I am here once again with the lovely, charming Lauren Bucus, who is most recently the author of The Shining Girls. Lauren, how are you doing?
I'm really good. I've just got off a plane. You always catch me at the craziest moments.
I did. And the thing about this conversation is that, we're doing this months before it actually airs. So what do you think is going to happen in May or June when this actually goes up?
Well, the book's launching in South Africa and the UK, so I've got a bit of international touring to do there first.
Uh-huh.
So it'll be nice to kind of gauge a response there. And I don't know,
Well, I think I was trying to get you to prognosticate on, will the world even exist?
Oh, right.
Or
yes.
What will happen, yeah.
Well, you know, I think the Mayans were off by a couple of months, so
I said
think
that 2013 is more the apocalyptic year than 2012.
Definitely, way more apocalyptic. And I think actually we're going to be overrun by killer bunnies that are taking revenge for the deaths of all the bees.
Yeah.
And we'll all be wiped out completely.
I learned recently that rats laugh. Did you know this?
No, I did not.
Yeah, rats actually laugh. If you tickle them, they emit this supersonic, high-pitched laughter that humans can't hear. I'm not sure if this factors into your prediction or not, but I bring it up just for
the hell of it. Well, they're going to use the rat laughter death ray. It's kind of a sonic death ray, which will just kind of explode all our cell phone devices, and we'll be cut off. And I know, I certainly will die without my cell phone.
Yeah, well, sure. Well, Lovecraft also probably predicted this too, the rats in the wall.
Absolutely.
Anyway, to your book, it is my view that the best zombie dramatizations do not involve an explanation. The zombies merely rise from the grave, and that's it. And it could be allegory, it could be gripping suspense. I bring this up because I think about the time travel in your book, which, for the most part, except for the end, we don't actually have an explanation for why this man, Harper, can jump from time to time. And when the explanation does come, I read it and said, oh, okay, yeah, that makes complete sense. But I was so willing to believe that he somehow willed himself into various times. So I have to ask you, Lauren Bucus, the author, did you have an explanation from the start? Why did you feel the need to give the reader the explanation for the time travel? And does narrative, is it hampered sometimes when you explain too much to the reader? What of this?
I don't like to explain too much to the reader. I like readers to bring you know, their depth and experience and interest into a text. And I think that makes it just way more interesting and exciting and personal. Over-explaining is boring, and I think you have to trust your reader, and I think you have to trust them with interesting definitions of how the world works. So I specifically went with the Greek tragedy model of time travel. You can't kill Hitler. The more you try to kill Hitler, the more you're just going to reinforce the events, which will absolutely play out the way it always has been intended to play out. Which is not to say that there aren't loops and paradoxes, or that the ending doesn't explain why everything has been happening.
Sounds like you've read Kate Ackett's Life After Life.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah. Gotcha.
So I really wanted to just kind of play with that. And the time travel is almost secondary to a lot of everything else. But everything has been immaculately plotted out. You know, I had this crazy murder wall with all these kind of diagrams and strings and three different crisscrossing timelines and linking them and triple checking that everything made sense and that the one moment which they keep looping back to, everything is very carefully coordinated. There's no looper moment where Bruce Willis says, well, I could explain time travel, but we'd be here all day doing diagrams with straws.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I really did plot it out and make sure everything worked.
I mean, how does spontaneity work for you in terms of if you have a foundation that you've set with strings? I'm very curious about the strings. I mean, Will Self has his post-it notes. You have the strings. How do you digress from that? How do you account for spontaneity? And does explanation sometimes get in the way of spontaneity?
I think explanation can. The way I write, and I'm going to paraphrase E.L. Doctorow, is that it's like taking a road trip at night. I know where I'm leaving from, and I know where I'm going to. I always know my beginnings and my endings, and I know some of the major kind of waypoints along the way. But the rest of the time you're driving, it's pitch black. You can see 20 feet ahead of you in the headlights, and you've just got to stay on the road and figure it out. And so the spontaneity in the play and the subconscious kind of diversions, which is my favorite part of the writing process, happens in between, you know.
So Harper, you knew how he did it.
I knew how Harper did it. I knew why it happens that way. That ending was in there from the beginning.
Sure. Which leads me to ask you about the strange perspective. I mean, here is a close third person.
Mm-hmm.
And as we read more and we start to understand that how he views his victims is very hallucinatory, especially with Etta the nurse, we start to really know that, he's probably making this up. And furthermore, he doesn't really quite understand sometimes that he's murdering these victims. This is interesting because it you're almost asking the reader here to share this blindness by making it third person. How did this stylistic tick develop, out of curiosity?
My previous two books were first person, and I really felt like I needed a break from that. I needed to be able to step back a little bit, especially because Harper is such a loathsome, vile person, which doesn't make us any less complicit, even though it's third person. It just felt natural for the book. You know, I would love to give you an in-depth analysis, but a lot of it is kind of flying on intuition.
Yeah.
And I wanted Harper to struggle with it, and I wanted you to see his struggle. I also did a lot of research into like what real serial killers are like, and I wanted to avoid the sexy, predatorial Hannibal Lecter model, you know, the sophisticate who drinks Chianti, and, you know, and most serial killers are awful, vile, pathetic human beings who have major sexual dysfunctions.
Yeah.
And I wanted to get at that, and the kind of real horror of like what that kind of monster is, and it's actually quite sad and pathetic, and no less horrible, but not the sophisticated predator.
Yeah. But it's also an interesting way of possibly avoiding full immersion into this guy's mind.
Mm.
Because as both author and reader, I mean, if you, during the course of your research, are growing increasingly queasy about what human beings do, well, you have a perfect safeguard here. Was that another aspect of doing this, another advantage here?
I could well have been a subconscious aspect. You know, the way I dealt with writing Harper was that I just messed him up at every opportunity. You know, if I could damage him in a scene, I absolutely would. You know, it was like, okay, he's in a fight with someone, I'm going to break his jaw.
Yeah.
Awesome. But then I had to keep track of the broken jaw and figure out how it was healing, and was it healed in like 1984, or was it still wired up in 1951?
Yeah.
And that just added a whole other layer of complexity. So it was very cathartic to hurt him. But it didn't help me with my planning.
Oh, so you were able to deal with this monster by beating the shit out of him.
Exactly.
Oh, interesting.
I fucked him up wholesale.
What do you feel about this notion? I mean, I've gotten into this with T.C. Boyle, where he's extremely cruel to his characters, and he sort of gives me this smile of, Yeah, that's right. How do you find empathy when you're constantly beating the hell out of your character?
Well, I think T.C. Boyle's probably beating the hell out of his nice characters.
Yeah.
And I'm thinking about the tortilla curtain, which was just devastating.
Yeah.
And I like to punish my good characters, but not to the point of... I mean, Harper was just... It was just punishing him was to make me feel better.
Yeah.
Well,
how does... I mean, if you're being vengeful towards your character, mm-hmm. how can you empathize with him?
Because I see how he's struggling with what he's dealing with. And actually injuring him makes him more human. It takes him more out of the realm of, again, that sexy apex predator. You know, he's a man. He gets hurt. And he gets his jaw broken. And he tears his tendon. He gets stung by a bee.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I think that actually makes him more human and more compelling and more relatable.
Many of your time periods are defined by pop culture, whether it's 3 months of Time magazine, one with an Arsenio cover, to wearing a Fugazi shirt in a waiting room, by the way, and also the baseball card as well. At other points, you have Dan saying things like, what this city needs is a camera on every corner, like a gas station. And as a result, when Dan says something like that, our view of a particular time period is informed by human viewpoint. I'm wondering, isn't a specific year more defined by how people behave or how they view the world around them? I was wondering how you balance pop culture versus behavior. Do you find that some of the pop cultural items allow you personally a way in when you don't quite know the period? What of this? How do you balance this?
I think it's both. I think pop culture references are an easy anchor point, but then you have to try and get the voice of the era and, as you said, the behavior. And we were talking about Studs Terkel earlier, and Studs Terkel, I did a lot of kind of reading and listening to his oral histories. And it was great just getting like different voices and different voices of eras and the things that people were interested in or passionate about and I did so much in-depth research. So I really did try to make each decade distinct and to really try and capture the mood of the time. But of course, you know, there are these pegs that you have to hang things on. And the Shiny Girls, the women who are murdered, are also representative of certain things. And I've picked out certain things of history that I'm interested in. It could just as easily have been something else.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to do a full Forrest Gump and, you know, have Harper, you know, going along to meet the president or whatever, and be present at major historical events. But, you know, we're dealing with the World
War II. I really was waiting for that Dick Cavett moment with Harper. Standing with Lenin right there.
Exactly, absolutely. But, you know, I do deal with World War II, and I deal with the Great Depression, and I deal with women's rights movement and kind of abortion providers in Chicago, and the McCarthyism. And there's so many resonances with today, and that's what was so terrifying.
Resonances such as what?
Well, McCarthyism, okay, first of all, I'm a South African writer, so the resonances of McCarthyism with apartheid and our special branch, our secret police, and what the FBI were doing, you know, they would go into a room and they would measure how the papers were laid out. They would draw diagrams on pieces of paper and, like, measure with rulers to make sure that once they'd finished searching, they could put the paper back exactly the same way. They would follow people to their homes. They had informants, you know, spying on people. They had teachers and friends and lovers and neighbors spying on each other. And it was completely insane. And I was like, wow, this is so South Africa.
Yeah.
I think there are a lot of resonances with today, with surveillance society and as Dan was, you know, suggesting, CCTV cameras on every corner, which was a sly kind of knowing wink to the audience.
Who needs them on every corner when we've got something like Google Glass? Completely. They'll be on every head.
I know. Yeah. It's completely crazy. So, you know, and the resonances with the Depression, women's rights. Margot Cooper is a illegal abortionist in 1972 and working for an amazing real-life organization called Jane. And at the time I was writing it, it was the American election happening, and the Republicans were saying the most insane shit about, like, legitimate rape and this debate was still going on 40 years later. More than 40 years later, 72 to, you know, yeah, 40 years.
Yeah.
And I just couldn't believe it. And it was incredible to explore how much things have changed, but also how terrifyingly many things have stayed the same.
I want to go back to the Studs Terkel conversations mm-hmm. you heard. Did they sometimes trigger some of the women in this book or a particular character? Because the sense I got reading some of these chapters was that, you know, I mean, like for example, there's the the graduate student in Chicago, and I said to myself, hey, that reminds me very much of the movie Candyman. And I wonder if Lauren had seen Candyman, and maybe that, like a cartoonist who sees an image and comes out with an entire story, whether it worked along those lines with you, both in terms of listening to Studs Terkel or possibly movies, or even the baseball game banter, which reminded me very much of Tracy and Hepburn in Woman of the Year. How does this work? Do you sometimes need to have a trigger point of something you watch or listen to or hear to in order to create a character like this and have it become more than simply a card that's pushpinned to the wall?
Yeah, it's I have a lot of influences. I have seen Candyman. I think a lot of stuff registers subconsciously. The college student murder was specifically based on a South African case.
Oh, interesting.
Not the details of the case, but just the description of the body and the violence of it and what it did to the family. And that's mentioned in the acknowledgements, which, of course, is not in your proof edition of the book. So you don't know about any of that stuff. But, I did a ton of research. I had real conversations with people. I interviewed a real Chicago cop. I hung out with real sports journalists in Chicago. I always like to write about stuff that I don't understand, and I really don't understand sport. I really, really don't. I don't get the appeal. I don't watch it. I don't know. So I went and spoke to a lot of sports journalists, and the conversation that Dan and Kirby and Kirby's ex-boyfriend have is based on real conversations I had with sports journalists, trying to tease out kind of the meaning. So
much of this is a way for you to understand subjects that you are kind of blind about.
Exactly. You know, with Zoo City, I was interested in the idea of redemption and forgiveness, because I find it very hard to forgive, you know, if people commit atrocities, I'm like, hang the bastards.
Yeah.
But the fact that South Africa has reconciled itself with the terrible things which happened in our past, I found very interesting, and I wanted to explore that in the book. And the same with this. I wanted to explore violence against women. I wanted to explore how the 20th century has shaped us, and I wanted to explore why baseball is a big deal.
So you find it very difficult to forgive people. Do you forgive Harper now that he has had his time in the novel?
I felt quite sorry for Harper. There's one point. I think he and I were both sick of killing by the end of the book. He and I were both just kind of like, please.
You have to forgive yourself in this case.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I have a friend of mine as a novelist, Sarah Lotz in South Africa, and she was so angry with me over like a couple of the murders. She was like, I can't speak to you again. I can't believe
really?
You did that. Yeah.
Why? What was the intensity of the murders that she objected to?
I think it was just, you know, I really try to get at the heart of like what violence is and what it does to us.
Yeah.
So it wasn't just about the sexy dead corpse with one kind of high heel and the splayed legs and the blonde hair and the pool of blood. It was about building up these real lives. And I think any of those women could have hopefully carried a novel by themselves. I really try to make them interesting, engaging people and explore their lives, and it was much more about their lives cruelly cut short than the horror of their deaths. So she was just very angry with me, in particular about the African-American welder Zora, who breaks Harper's jaw, which was great, but she dies horribly, and she had kids, and my friend Sarah kept saying to me, but she had kids. I'm like, you know, she's imaginary, right?
Yeah, well, you did your job correctly.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
I want to go back to what we were talking earlier in terms of how you are inspired, either by interviews or by Studs Terkel conversations that you hear. Do you need to have something concrete to work from every time? Who was the most imagined character in The Shining Girls, the one that came most from just second-guessing, or do you need to always have that framework? Does this go back to your journalistic roots?
The details go back to the journalistic roots, but all those women are completely invented. They're all fabricated. Harper's fabricated. Everyone is straight out of my imagination. But it's more kind of the time period, and it's picking up an ambiance from my research. It's about the underlying melody. I might be reaching. That was a reach.
Was it? Underlying melody. The melody of stabbing a woman.
Let's just cut that. Wow. Never mind then.
Oh boy. So I wanted to actually ask you about this. You have alluded that you have actually lived in Chicago. And this book, of course, is set in Chicago. I know you're working on another novel that is set in Michigan. I wanted to ask you about this. What is it about this Midwestern region that speaks to, I suppose, an idea of America that you want to pursue in fiction? What is it about this particular territory? I know you were there, but do you think that, say, that area has more to say about America than bi-coastal regions?
I think the coastal regions have been covered quite heavily. I've also lived in New York, and I love San Francisco, and I would totally love to write a book there. I was interested in Chicago because I'd lived there. And I felt like I had enough of a sense of the place to be able to write about it. And then my new book, Broken Monsters, is set in Detroit. And I was very interested in Detroit as all the heavy symbolism that people put on that city. You know, the birth of the American dream, the death of the American dream, the phoenix rising of the American dream once more. And how to play out kind of a normal lives there, but also crazy, horrible murders, because, you know, that's what I do. I think Detroit has a lot in common with Hillbrow, which was that's inner city Johannesburg, which is where Zoo City was set, where outsiders perceive it as being kind of just devastation and ruin and decay and blight and poverty. But actually, it's somewhere people live.
Yeah.
And that's what I wanted to get at. So I'm kind of picking cities which have resonances for me with the stuff that I already know.
Yeah. Did you spend any time in Detroit?
Yeah, I went on a research trip last year. It was absolutely amazing.
How long were you there?
Only a week. Okay. But I've been reading all the books on Detroit, and I've been corresponding with friends. And, you know, again, I just did a ton of interviews.
Did you read Mark Benelli's book?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Fantastic. And I'm trying to get hold of, I think it's Charlie LaDuff's book on Detroit.
Yes, I haven't read that.
I think it's just come out.
Yeah, cool. So the U.S. Radium Corporation's exploitation of women in their factories, mm-hmm. whereby women were painting these dials on the watches.
Undock.
Yes, exposed to radium. One of the real dark chapters of American history. You have a radium girl in this who was also an exotic dancer. I was curious about this. Did you find any real historical precedent for this? Were there radium girls formerly employed who then went on to do things like this? I was fascinated by this. I regrettably did not actually have the time to research this, so I'm just going to ask you.
Absolutely. I paid a researcher. I had two researchers working for me.
Wow.
It just saved me a lot of time because there's so much historical detail that you want to get right.
Yeah.
So my researcher, Adam, was looking for... I was like, I need details on 1930s hospitals. I need to know how much it cost. I need to know how they would have treated a torn tendon. Please can you find that out for me? And maybe descriptions and photographs. And then he would go and do that while I carried on writing. And he was like, okay, well, here's all the information you need. And by the way, I found this amazing article I thought you might be interested in. And it was about a real-life glow girl. And it was an exotic dancer in 1936 who danced in radium paint. And there's a chapter in the book which is taken directly from that article. And it's using some of the original language from that article. It was originally printed in the Milwaukee Sentinel, and I got their permission to quote from it.
Milwaukee Sentinel, what year?
1936.
1936, yeah. Okay. I'll check this out. Did you find it on Google News Archives?
Yeah.
Okay, I'll check
it out. And it was really fantastic. And the way she speaks with this kind of French accent, and maybe the original... My girl is actually from Boston. She's putting on a fake French accent. But I think the real girl might have really been from France. But... In the article, she speaks with the French accent, and she says, please tell the boys, they must not be scared of me. You know, and it's just, but with all the Z's and all the Z's, and it's just wonderful. And I reproduced some of those sentences directly. It was great.
You can use Z on this program. Oh, that's interesting. So is this often what you sometimes do, that you, if it's a historical figure who has been dead for quite some time, their dialogue is fair game?
No, I mean, I specifically went and asked for permission on that.
Okay.
So, you know, it's not usually what I do, but having been a journalist for a long time, I know that real life is often more inventive and surprising than anything you could make up. I do take some liberties with some real people. Like, there's a baseball player, Maddox, and, yeah. You know, I put some words in his mouth, which I'm sure he never said or anything remotely like that, but it's based on real events.
So when did you start hiring the researchers, having this, yeah, you've got two full-time researchers?
No, not full-time. It
part-time.
Was just kind of part-time. Okay. And one was in South Africa kind of one day a week. And the other was this guy, Adam, who runs a company called Skyward Star, which is actually named for my first book, Moxieland.
Uh-huh.
So I put out this call for researchers on Twitter, and they both responded.
Oh, wow.
And he was like, I need my company for you. You have to take me.
That's the best way to get a job.
Completely.
I mean, that's something that people can use in this economy. So, I mean, when did you stop researching material on your own? Why did you find that so exhausting?
No, you know what? It was the little details. You know, like, what I would do is I would get Zara, my South African researcher. I was like, okay, I'm doing something in McCarthyism. She had access to the University of Cape Town Library. And I said, and we looked it up and we found a book on the Red Scare. And I was like, please go get me that book. And she got me the book and I would read the entire book. But it was a little pesky, annoying details. Like, in one chapter, Zora, the African-American welder, is a young teenager, and she's sitting on the stairs outside her house when Harper first approaches her. And it was one tiny plot hole that I had to fix. She was too young in the original draft, which is one you've read. And I had to make her older, and I had her folding paper planes for her brother. But I'm like, okay, did they have paper planes in 1931? And it was that kind of, you know, that could take you like 2 hours to research. So it was that kind of information that I farmed out. I did the big heavy lifting, but it was the small little details like what was on TV in 1973? You know, which episode of The Twilight Zone would Kirby have been freaked out when her mother hadn't come out, you know, come home yet? And that was the information that they would find for me.
John Banville described this early period in his career where he would research the hell out of something. And then he eventually said, you know, this is far too much work. It's getting in the way of writing fiction. Have you encountered that acceptable boundary between invention and too much research?
I think, you know, I get to a point where I stop, where I'm like, okay, I've got what I need. You know, with, again, coming back to Zora the Welder, you know, I watched the hell out of all the YouTube videos on the landing ship tanks and the Chicago Bridge and Iron Company and how they launched the boats into the river. And that took about like 3 hours, and then I wrote the chapter and that was fine. But with the Red Scare, I didn't feel like I needed to read the entire book. You know, I picked out some chapters and I picked out some interesting moments and thoughts and how people thought about it and the major intensive points. The problem is not when to stop researching, because at some point I have to get on with the book and I know that's my primary focus. The problem is all the amazing stuff you found that you want to squeeze in somehow. Yeah. And you just can't, because it would be too much of an info dump. You know, I wanted to talk about the original radium, the woman who painted the Undocked Dials, who used to dip their paintbrushes in the radium paint and then lick the brushes, and it rotted their jaws. Apparently their jaws were like honeycomb. And I wanted to get all that in, and I couldn't. There was absolutely no way to put that into the conversation. It would have been such a, you know, obviously squashed in historical reference. The same with the first time nuclear fission was accomplished.
Yeah.
Was at the University of Chicago. And I managed to get a mention of it in to the chapter on the architect during McCarthyism in 1951. But I originally had like 2 pages, and I had to cut it out. It was just too much, and it wasn't relevant, and it was just heartbreaking, because there was all this fascinating history that I wanted to get in, and I just couldn't, and I was like, ah! So I had to rein myself in.
On the flip side, though, there's probably a few moments in this book where a chapter became so dominant, so beholden to this research that it actually took over other elements. I mean, did that occur as well? Clearly you had no problem of extirpating the info dumps, but I'm wondering if something that became more than an info dump actually invaded the chapter in ways that you never expected.
I don't know specifically. You know, I think Alice Templeton, who is a dancer in a girly show at the county fair in 1941, her chapter got really long because I was really enjoying it, and I probably shouldn't have spent that much time with her. I don't think anything really took over anywhere else. But it was also interesting, you know, because I did a lot of location scouts as well. So later on, when Harper comes back for Alice, and he takes her, he says he's going to take her dancing at the Congress Hotel, but then he ends up with this huge chase scene through the back corridors. And that's because I actually went to the Congress Hotel with a young ghost hunter, ghost tour guide, I should say, and young historian called Adam Seltzer. And he and I were like, you know, running through the back corridors, and it was great to be able to bring that kind of real detail in again.
Did you find Alice? Was there a real life exemplar for her?
No.
No,
no, that was purely invented.
That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And that spirit expanded. Interesting. Oh, I actually wanted to talk to you about this aspect of your book. Kirby has survived an attempted murder. One of the interesting qualities of Kirby is when she is having sexual relations with various men, which now that seems sounds formal. All right.
She's getting laid.
Yeah. She's getting laid. And these men are looking at her entirely based on her scars. They either go directly to the scars to kiss it, or they ignore it and are horrified by it altogether. And it's an intriguing way of how she's not objectified by her body, but she's objectified by the scars. And I'm wondering, you know, how did this come about? Was it a matter of just sort of thinking about Kirby in terms of, well, if she's going to get involved with men, this is what's going to happen? I mean, how did the fixation on her scars come about? Is there a sort of subculture out there of people who have been scarred who have had to deal with this particular problem? Because I found it really quite striking and moving. Yeah.
I think, again, that comes from something I internalized along the way. I think that probably comes from the documentary Motorball, which is about guys in wheelchairs.
Yes, paraplegics. Who do sports and all. Yeah,
absolutely. And I think, you know, there was a very explicit and moving section on their sex lives. And I think it comes from that. It also comes from you having spoken to people who have had something traumatic and terrible happen to them, and how you know, it's not just the men she sleeps with. It's her friends. It's everyone she comes into contact with. They're like, oh, you're that girl. And it becomes the defining thing about her, and she can't escape it because the one particular scar is on her throat, and it's so visible. I was really kind of exploring that. Again, it ties into a South African story of an even worse attack than what Kirby went through. And the woman survived it, and she wrote a memoir about it, but it was an absolutely horrific attack in the 90s, I think. I read her whole biography, and I looked at what her experience was like and how she dealt with it, and how people responded to her.
To a certain degree, if you have a scar, it's going to actually condemn you further than if you have a disease, or if you have a disability, or if you know you're exhausted or something like that. I find it really interesting that this condemns women from a certain male vantage point more than, I suppose, debilitating diseases. Anyway.
Well, I think it says victim. As soon as she steps out in public, it is there immediately. And I think there are themes which run through my work, and this is the first time I've actually thought about this, but it's exactly the same in Zoo City, where Zinzi carries a sloth with her, and it's immediately a physical marker that she is different, that she is damaged, that something terrible has happened to her, that she's done something terrible. And Kirby's kind of living with the same thing.
Do you need to define a character from their physicality in order to really flesh them out, so to speak?
I'm much more interested in the interior. I don't go very heavy on like the character descriptions. I think that Kirby has brown hair and brown wild hair and brown eyes, and that's really all I give you, and the scars.
Yeah.
I really like people to be able to I don't cast. On my murder wall, I had pictures of women. But it was more, again, about a certain feel and getting that ambience. I would find pictures online, or I would take pictures that captured some evocative idea of a person rather than, oh, well, she looks exactly like this.
So you had photos on the wall, not so much as visual reference, but as emotional reference.
Exactly. Huh. Absolutely. And I when I was doing my location scouts in Chicago, I took lots of photographs on my cell phone. And some of those have actually made that onto the South African cover, which is very cool.
Wow.
And again, I would put those up on the wall so that I would have that kind of idea, or just remember, oh gosh, like the grass there is really long and tufted, and it would bring back the smell and the sound of the birds or whatever it was.
So this is pure emotional association, these photos.
Absolutely.
Huh. So I'm wondering, when you are associating like this, does your imagination get in the way of memory? Is this actually a helpful point for devising fiction?
Imagination comes first. Yeah. Like the real detail's great, but then I'm not going to sacrifice the story or my imagination or where I want to go with something based on what actually happened or the reality of something.
So there's one question I wanted to ask you, and it's largely a weird fixation I've had in 2013, and that involves Canadian Club.
Mm-hmm.
You
warned me about this question.
I did warn you about this question, but I have to ask you. So I have noticed a number of novels that involving sociopaths, and they drink Canadian Club. There's another great book by Amity Gage called Schroeder, and this guy, who's also a sociopath, also is fond of Canadian Club. You have Harper fond of Canadian Club. You go back to A Clockwork Orange, and they're drinking Veterans, and of course, it offers a Canadian lime option. So I want to just put forth your thoughts on this matter, because I just can't stop thinking about this. What is it about Canadian liquor and sociopaths that just matches like peanut butter and jelly?
The truth is that they're actually paying me. It's kind of product placement. But they didn't realize I wasn't going for the sexy psychopath.
Yeah.
So I think they're going to be a bit disappointed and demand their money back. I think again, it was just a pop culture reference that I picked up. I think they drink Canadian Club in Boardwalk Empire. Yeah. I think it's one of the major imports.
There's also the Al Capone reference. Yeah, Al Capone exactly. Loved Canadian Club.
Exactly. And you know, we're talking about Chicago in the 30s. It was run by Capone. And I specifically didn't want to get into Capone. I didn't want to have Harper hanging out with him or going gambling at one of his joints. You know, again, no Forrest Gump thing.
Yeah.
But I did want you to know that was the era it was set in, and to have that kind of one or two references. And I referenced Capone's right-hand man.
But do you feel that, like, Canada plus drunkenness equals
optimal
conditions
evil
for sociopathy?
I don't know. I'll have to go drink some more and tell you.
We should get authors to drink a bunch of Canadian Club and see what they come up with. I don't know.
So yeah, I think we can devise a really great scientific experiment around this.
You were mentioning photographs earlier, and I noticed that the name Velasquez shows up near the end of the book, and I, of course, thought of the wonderful masterpiece Las Meninas, with the painter and the mirrors. It's a marvelous, marvelous masterpiece. And in light of the fact of what you just said about photographs, I'm wondering if Las Meninas was in any way a kind of inspiration for working this distortion angle with Harper and everything else.
Yes, I don't know.
Yeah. were paintings an inspiration as well as photographs?
Art is always something I'm interested in. I didn't specifically have paintings that I referenced, but it's again just, you know, I have broad cultural appetites, so I might have, you know, chomped on that along the way.
How do you typically chomp on something? Is it are you a slow eater, or are you?
No, I'm you know, I'm the.
You wolf down your meal.
I'm the rabid wolf at the buffet, just kind of grabbing little bits of everything.
Okay. Well, on that gustatory note, Lauren, thanks so much. It was a pleasure to chat with you.
Thanks so much.
All right.